and answer session today. If you weren't here yesterday, I'll just go over how it's going to work one more time, and then I won't have to repeat myself going forward. So this is going to be recorded, both the question and answer sessions, which means that if you are answering a question, you are going to be recorded and put up on the retreat website, which is only available to people who have registered on this retreat. If you would prefer to stay anonymous, or then I would turn off your video. If you want to remain super anonymous, you could rename yourself as well. If you still have a question to ask, then write to me in the chat box and I'll ask it on your behalf. I'm happy to do that. We do love hearing people's voices though. So if you're feeling brave, or you want to, if you've taken the courage from Tara this morning, then do step into this space and ask a question. And for the benefit of those people who are kind of listening in rather than looking in, it would be great if you, before your question, you could say your name. And I quite like to know where people are calling from. It gives me like a mental map of where we all are in this virtual field. But mostly your name is would be great. So, yes, anything goes, really. We can pick up from topics that we left off yesterday, which was things like the relationship between the ascent and the descent view of the spiritual life, the spiritual path. There was questions about the relentless pursuit of progress as opposed to natural growth. It's good. There's things drawn out of Bodhi Leela's talk this morning, which our group talked about a bit, which is how the poem kind of touches on ethics and this idea of right doing and wrongdoing, and how we might burden ourselves with what's right, what's wrong, inherited ideas and views, and how they play out in the world that aren't so helpful, aren't so skillful. Yes. We also touched on bardos generally in terms of the big picture and the pandemic point in history, but also a very specific and personal felt sense of a bardo in terms of Vedana, and how that might be a thread to this place between wrongdoing and right doing. So everyone's ready now. So I'm feel free to write in the chat box a question, or unmute and just offer the question into the space.
Hello. Hi, it's Mark from New York, and I have a couple of questions, and some came up from the group that we were in, and some I just have questions. One is about the ascent and descent. And coming from the sort of Catholic background that I'm curious, when you're speaking of that paramananda, I interpreting that correctly, that you're not speaking of it in terms of like heaven and the netherworld, or good emotions and bad emotions, and if you could kind of go into that a little bit, because we talk of above and below and these, so I'm curious as to, and I have a good sense of it, that that's not the case, but it would still be helpful to hear you elaborate on that a bit. How do we, is that tied to our experience when meditating, that we're bringing emotions from different places? But then when we say that a emotion is below another emotion, we immediately go into a hierarchy. The one is above is better, I think, which kind of goes to the point of progress, which is another thing. But the other part, that the other real question I think that's come up is, how does one integrate the process that we're going through right now, the retreat? how do we not maintain, but how do we integrate that into our daily life? How does the retreat, how do we not leave the retreat is essentially what I'm saying, that we're just in retreat mode, that actually everything else that we do outside that we think we're not doing on retreat, that we're just kind of staying in retreat. Do you follow, that our priorities have shifted in that direction?
Hi, Mark. I haven't got the ascent and descent issue. And then maybe by the leader can have a go at the staying in retreat issue. I think primarily, but not by any means exclusively, when we're talking about ascent and descent in relation to actual meditation, we're talking about the relationship between what might be regarded in one way of speaking, difficult or negative emotion, as opposed to what are sometimes called positive emotions. And I think what we're trying to get at is what's the relationship between those types of energy and becoming whole, if you like, becoming complete, and how do we avoid the danger of repressing the parts of us we don't like? So I think one of the abiding dangers of all spiritual traditions, really, is that the habits, emotions, tendencies that are not supported by that particular belief structure get pushed down into the shadows, and then of course they still come out, but they come out in very, very negative, very destructive ways. I mean, you mentioned coming from a Catholic background, so you know we've got a very clear example of how, you know, the wish to be celibate, to repress sexual energy, has unfortunately come out in a very negative way in that tradition. And of course, that's happened in all traditions to some degree or other. And I think as individuals, it's like, how do we have a full-bodied experience of ourselves, which includes what we might consider to be negative emotion, whether it's anger or depression or jealousy or envy, all these emotions that we actually all experience, how do they get included in, rather than rather than them being repressed and therefore us really just operating on half a tank or operating on very limited energy in a way? Because so I think this idea of descent is trying to make a case for a conscious going down into this material. Not only that, but also in a way a mythologizing of this material. So we depersonalize it. So it doesn't result in self-hatred. It was interesting to me in that puja yesterday, this morning, with all those confessions, and I think, well, how do, because to confess, I thought it, perhaps that's rather unfortunate language for some of us. I don't come from a Catholic background, but to say confession in our Western tradition tends to imply sin. And it tends to imply having to seek forgiveness from God or a priest, whatever. Because Buddhism doesn't have sin, it doesn't have sin. We're not sinning against some supernatural force, even when we behave unethically. We're not sinning against anything, And so, we've got to be careful when we think about confession. So the the interesting thing, I think, is how do we recognize that? Of course, we do suffer from anger or jealousy or pettiness or fear or whatever it is. How do we recognize that? How do we actually encounter, turn towards that with love, with love and openness? And when we do that, of course, some possibility of that energy being redirected, that possibility opens up, that energy can actually be used in a positive way rather than turned against ourselves or turned against other people. So I think this idea of descent is that there's a wisdom down there in this dark material, the dark material, the difficult material. There's actually a wisdom. We can learn about ourselves more fully, and we can come into a loving relationship with these aspects of ourselves. And by doing that, it's riding the dragon, isn't it? I remember Bhante, in Buddhism, dragons are largely replaced by the Naga. And Bhante Sangharaja said, well, Nagas are ethically neutral. They're just energy. So it's like that energy that we might experience as hate has also got the potential to be energy for something very positive, if we can learn to ride it in the right way, if we can learn to be in the right relationship. So it's not... this is a very, it's a very complicated area in a way, and we will be exploring it throughout the whole retreat, I think, because I'm talking about it on a kind of rational, emotional level, but of course, to some extent, we can work with this type of energy on a completely physical level, as a physical release, as a holding that go on in the body. Primarily physical, or perhaps I shouldn't say primarily physical, but they have a physical aspect. So sometimes we can work with these things just on a physical level, and they don't even have to be pathologized or psychologized at all. They're just physical holdings that can be released. So in one way of working, and I think this is the more we work in a body-based way, the more we're moving away from this kind of psychological interpretation, which of course has got validity, not that it's not valid, but the question is that as meditators, are we working primarily psychologically? And if we are, is that the appropriate place to work psychologically? Or is there a more energetic way of working in meditation? And of course, it's not black and white, it's not one or the other, but I think the tendency in the West is to emphasize this kind of, well, anyway, perhaps I've said enough, I could go, there's no quick answers to these questions, I'm afraid, but we can work, keep asking the questions, and we'll keep trying to open up as we go through. Now, I leave it there, otherwise I'm at risk of just going on.
Thank you.
Yeah, hope that helps a bit, Mark. And maybe Bodhilina, would you like to address the staying in retreat modality?
Actually, I'd much rather come in with the first one, actually. But,
okay.
I do think that's such an interesting area for all of us, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's how we can include all of our experience. And I think it's also not as straightforward as that we avoid the descent. Some of us might avoid the ascent,
and
we might be repressing all the sort of more, well, the joy, the happiness, the confidence. It's not, it's more comfortable to have low self-esteem than have a more positive self-esteem. It's more, and be quite attached to a view of ourselves and to patterns of behavior and feelings and emotions because they're familiar and that's what we grew up with, rather than take the risk of change or letting some of them go. So I think we need to turn towards what is there and embrace everything at some point. And I don't think the two are separated. I know for me, every time that I've allowed myself in a way to go to the depths and kind of see something, own something, integrate something. Almost inevitably, then my meditation practice opens up. There's sort of more spacious, there's more depth, there's more. And quite often that's the time when I might be experiencing more dhyanic states. You know, I don't think the two are completely separate. And I think when you're in the more positive states of mind, or when you've got more spaciousness, and when you're in the body and you've got that kind of connection, then it's much more possible to hold the difficult, challenging emotions. Because I don't know about you, but I used to get into these states and stay in them forever, or get very, very identified with particular emotions and not realize that that was just part of my experience. Yeah. And also I used to have this real fear of anger and hatred and rage kind of stuff, because I thought that it would be abusive or not, I'd be really destructive and stuff like that. And also that made me a really bad person. But I think there's something about, well, that is just part of the human experience. And actually, I think anger is just karmically neutral, really. When we direct that anger in a way that harms someone, whether it's ourselves or others, that's when it becomes unskillful. But otherwise, it's energy, you know, and that energy can clear things, and it can also alert us that something's not right. Often we feel anger in response to something that's not right or unfair, isn't it? And we have these wrathful figures, don't we, in the particularly in the sort of Tibetan Mahayana tradition. You've probably seen the images of them. They're the flames and stomping, and they look like demons, and they've got skulls and whatever it is. And there's something about that energy that clears away all the obstacles and all the things that are getting in the way of your practice, your progress, or you being who you are. And I think we sometimes need that energy, don't we? There's a whole set of ethical precepts from the Tibetan tradition which sees, rather than the five precepts we're used to, it's all in terms of energy, you know. And one of the things about not blocking energy and not blocking other people's energy. And I think quite often when we repress whatever emotion it is, it could be grief, it could be joy, it could be anger, it could be creativity, that's when we're blocking our energy, and it doesn't usually have good effects. And I think when we're meditating, we are working with on an energetic level and a physical level, an emotional level, and all kinds of levels at the same time, really. But I think it's very easy to think in terms of you're working with your mind and your thoughts, working with distractions. I mean, you were talking about good emotions and bad emotions. We bring those kinds of view strip rather than just seeing this is what's happening, this is what's present, you know. So I think that whole thing about the psychological and the meditative, I think because there can be quite a lot of overlap, because when we start meditating, it's very intimate, isn't it? If we stick with it, we really get to know ourselves, we turn towards ourselves, we see all our habits, our patterns, our views, we feel more aware of our emotions, we might get in touch with all kinds of memories.
Well, depending how we meditate, of course. I think that's the problem, isn't it? There's a way of meditating where you don't get in touch with that material. And that is in a sense, you know, if the meditation is just orientated towards a sense, you won't necessarily get in touch with that material. Or you won't think that that material is part of the meditative practice. You'll think they're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
So there's some, I think that the thing for me, Bodhilin, is that there has to be a valuing of the dissent. We have natural rhythms in our life, and sometimes we are what gets pathologized as depressed. Actually, that might be a very valuable state that we should allow ourselves to inhabit. Anyway, as I say, I mean, yeah, what you say is exactly right, though, yeah, of course.
Yeah, it's that not thinking any part of our experiences aren't acceptable, being able to allow it, I think. I mean, it's interesting, you know, the Metta Bhavana practice, and if you do the other Brahma Viharas practices, which have sort of similar structure of the kind of people you bring to mind in the different stages. So when you get to the fourth stage and the person that you might be feeling ill will or hatred towards, the enemy stage, which is often kind of, you know, a little whitewashed in calling it the difficult person stage, whereas actually it's that we've got difficult feelings towards them, and that the difficult feelings might be anger and rage and hatred, kind of thing that we don't actually want to name, even if it's just a little bit on the continuum. But for me, I really find that stage quite a mirror, because why have I put that person in the stage? And invariably it's because there's something about them that reminds me of something I don't like about myself, or that I'm projecting out onto them, or possibly in a more personal way, they haven't done what I've wanted them to do, or they've done something that I haven't liked, so I've had an unpleasant Baden-Art response. So it's always self-referential for me, that fourth stage. And if I can allow myself to be who I am with all my faults, or if you want, all my unskillful stuff, feelings, whatever, messiness, my capacity to be destructive, whatever else, then I'm much more able to allow other people to be who they are and to be more empathic and not so judgmental. I mean, beyond the ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, that came up in our group, that there's that critical voice, that inner critical voice that has says that's wrong, that's right, you know. And the more we can soften that up, the more we can allow ourselves, accept ourselves, then the less we're likely to also treat other people in that way.
Yes, well, thank you both, yeah.
All right. We have a question popped up in the chat box. Let me just find it. Could you please expand on the theme of duality in relation to the pandemic? In relation to the theme of duality in yesterday's talk, relating it to COVID-19.
Oh, I don't know.
Sorry.
I don't know if I can. I'm not quite sure what's been got at there, in a way. The pandemic in relationship to duality. I'm not quite, you know, that, give me a moment on that one.
I mean, I know you talked about it in relationship to it being a bardo, and when things get interrupted or disrupted, then there's space for something else to emerge. I don't remember it in terms of duality.
I mean, it is quite interesting, isn't it? I suppose one duality that, I mean, I did invoke the god Pan, didn't I? As the god of pandemics, in a way, you know. And of course, what you've got in Pan, as I mentioned yesterday, is the only major god that's half animal. So you've got the instinctual, very much the animal and the human brought together. And I think there's some connection there. I mean I do feel that the pandemic is to some extent Pan's revenge, if we were to talk about it in our terms, you know, to some extent, this is the revenge of Pan, you know, and it's because of this severance, you know, this we've constructed an artificial duality between human consciousness and consciousness, and this is something that's gone on very strongly for. Well, probably for about at least the last 3,000, probably the last 7,000 years or something, where we've increasingly, gradually appropriated consciousness as a purely human thing and rendered the rest of the cosmos dead in the sense of possessing no psyche. So this, in a sense, this is a really extreme form of dualism where we believe we're the only thing in the cosmos that has psyche, has consciousness. And of course, the old view, or I'm more or less inclined to say the natural view, the indigenous view, which, you know, we still encounter in certain indigenous peoples, is that everything has psyche. Everything has psyche. Plants have psyche, rocks have psyche, everything has psyche. The universe has psyche. You know, it doesn't just come, you know, it's not just a human property. So in a way, that fundamental, we've split ourselves off from the rest of creation, if you want, the rest of the cosmos, and enthroned ourselves above everything else. So I don't know if that's anything to do with what the questioner was asking, really, but that's what comes to mind, really.
And the person's no longer on the chat to ask, so
it was a
question on behalf of someone, so they'll get that on the
well, they can have a follow up question if I completely missed the point, maybe. I don't know.
Okay, it's
not the first time.
And I've just been reminded in the chat box that I may have overlooked a question, which doesn't have to be addressed right now, but at some point. Mark's second question about how to stay in retreat mode in the midst of the everyday.
Well, my reluctance to answer that was that really my everyday isn't so much different, you know. I mean, generally in my life for many years now, really, I mean, my everyday life isn't so different, really, from my retreat life. And my everyday life aren't radically that much different. So I was a bit reluctant to answer that question because I didn't know that I really was representative of people that have real, I mean, I haven't had a real job since my late 20s, you know.
Well, I think for me it's just a sort of natural extension of we're not just practicing on the cushion, you know. And I think it's quite easy to get dualistic, you know, we're meditating, we're not meditating. We're working on our minds or whatever it is. Maybe we're more embodied when we're meditating, and then we go off and do whatever else it is, and we forget all of that. But it's the same body, it's the same mind, it's the same habits, views, conditioning that we're bringing. And in a way, but for me, it's the more I practice, the more close those two become. You know, if I'm used to noticing all my responses, my reactions, or whatever, if I become a bit more aware of what's going on for me in meditation, that means that often I can bring that kind of awareness into my everyday life. You know, you can always become aware of the breath, you can always become aware of the body, you can always sort of tune in with how you're feeling, and you can notice those same patterns, that same reactivity in real life, you know, in response to a particular situation or particular person. So there's that anyway, but obviously when we go on retreat, it can be a bit more extreme. If it's a residential retreat, you go on for maybe have this really deep experience that's like nothing you've had before, and then you come back and you're just straight into your work or whatever else it is, and that can often be a very difficult transition. So I actually think doing a retreat like this has much more potential for less of that splitting, because you're actually in your home or whatever environment you're in practicing, and then almost in the midst of your everyday life. You know, even though some people might have taken some time off to make this a slightly more spacious time, a lot of people, if you're living with people, you're still living with those people. You know, people might have some work commitments and things they're having to do alongside this. And also, even if you're not, you've got all your normal things around you. So I was sort of noticing last night, I was thinking, oh, shall I go onto Netflix? If I was on retreat, I wouldn't be binging TV. So no, I'm not going to do that. But at least, you know, we have to make those sorts of choices when we're at home, you know. don't know if that answers your question.
Yes, I find it really helpful, actually. And most, I like retreats too, where I'm away and I'm in a sort of special place and it's very protected and the conditions are all really positive to, but I guess most of the time I'm here. I'm not on retreat. And so how does one take that mindset and apply it to our daily life, I guess? You know, how do you keep that same mindset into one's daily life? That's always been the struggle for me. And this, an online retreat makes it easier to do that because it's reinforced throughout the day, I guess. I'm happy that we're doing this, I guess. And I'm happy that you're doing this. And I did want to say thank you all. Yeah.
And I think practicing ethics is a way of bringing it into our everyday life, isn't it? Because the ethics, we need to be aware of our mental states and our motivations and our actions and stuff. And I just think, we just do it, don't we? We just see.
Just a time check. We're actually at time. It's 5:30, but that was about to open up into another giant conversation, which is definitely worth reflecting on overnight. So while I'm talking, if you have any questions that were on the tip of your tongue, do write it in the chat box now or email teaching@westlondonbuddhacentre.com and Praninita will pick them up and hand them over to us. Otherwise, thank you for your questions. See you tomorrow.
Thank you, Sophie.
Yeah, thanks, Sophie.
Have a nice evening, everybody, eh?